Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepanczyk. On today's show, we'll feature a truth track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week's truth track is entitled, The Ironies of Kello v. New London, Connecticut. We'll also include a summary of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. Conservative Christians celebrate U.S. troop deaths. The Federal Communications Commission shuts down a popular community radio station. The governor of Rhode Island vetoes medical marijuana legislation. And labor factions outline plans for a July 2005 Chicago convention. Followers of a reverend who blames the nation's immorality for the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks picketed the funeral of a fallen soldier in Marblehead, Massachusetts, on the week of June 30, 2005. The Los Angeles Times reported that Reverend Fred Phelps and his followers shouted at mourners outside the church at which services for Army Staff Sergeant Christopher Piper were being held, only to be drowned out by bagpipers from the Boston Police Department. Piper died in Afghanistan on June 3, 2005, after the Humvee he was in hit a roadside bomb, according to the newspaper. About 14 parishioners of the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas, have been joining Phelps in staging protests around Massachusetts, which is the only state in the nation to allow same-sex marriages. Westboro is a primitive Baptist congregation, members of which have been aggressively demonstrating against gays for over 24 years. Phelps made news in 1998 for wearing a shirt with a defamatory statement at the funeral of Matthew Shepard, a student who was brutally murdered for being gay. Shortly after the 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, Phelps again made news, blaming the attacks on the nation's arguably growing acceptance of homosexuality. In June 2005, the Boston Herald reported that the congregation also planned to protest another fallen soldier's funeral, that of Marine Captain John Mahoney, a Chicopee, Massachusetts resident. In early June 2005, Phelps's group picketed several churches in Lexington, Massachusetts, because they are tolerant of homosexuals, according to the Boston Globe. Ignoring a pending court case and a local community's expressed desire, the Federal Communications Commission raided a low-frequency Vermont community radio station on the morning of June 23, 2005, seizing over $15,000 worth of equipment and forcing the station off the air. This was the second time that the station, called Radio Free Brattleboro, had been shut down in 2 years. The station began broadcasting in 1998 and continued doing so for 5 years, until the FCC ordered it to cease operating without a license, according to various news accounts. The station complied with the request and went off the air for 2 months as it gathered supporting signatures on a petition in lieu of filing for a license, which the FCC does not offer for stations broadcasting at 10 or fewer watts, according to Radio Free Brattleboro organizers in a statement on the station's website. Reportedly, the FCC's 2003 action came about because the station's broadcasts interfered with those of a Massachusetts public radio station. The organizer's statement noted that Radio Free Brattleboro began broadcasting over a different frequency in August 2003, 2 months after the initial FCC visit. The FCC seizure occurred as the station and the FCC await a court decision on preliminary motions arising from that incident and subsequent efforts by the federal agency to shut the station down permanently. Radio Free Brattleboro obtained a temporary stay on the FCC's order in 2004, and the case has yet to go to trial, according to the Brattleboro Reformer. The Brattleboro community has been largely supportive throughout the ordeal. In 2003, the Brattleboro Select Board passed a resolution of support for the station by a 4-to-1 vote. A local referendum of support passed by a 2-to-1 margin in March 2005, according to the Vermont Guardian. In a letter to U.S. Attorney David V. Kirby in January 2005, station organizers noted that they gathered over 2,000 signatures in support of the community radio effort. Radio Free Brattleboro intends to permanently leave the airwaves as soon as a 100-watt station modeled on the open-format community station takes to the air later in 2005, according to various newspaper accounts. With the stroke of a pen, Rhode Island Governor Donald L. Carcieri slammed the lid on a freshly passed marijuana medical bill on the week of July 1, 2005. Governor Carcieri wrote, "This bill's noble goals cannot mask its serious safety flaws. This bill will increase the availability of marijuana on the streets of our state." Close quote. By a 33-1 vote, the state Senate gave approval to legislation that allowed people with debilitating illnesses to use marijuana under doctor supervision, paving the way for final General Assembly approval. A sister bill passed the House by a 52-10 vote in early June 2005. The final measure would also have allowed patients to grow cannabis and possess up to 2.5 ounces of the plant. Users were to be issued a state identification card to mitigate possible problems with state law enforcement. Governor Carcieri's veto was widely expected. According to the Marijuana Policy Project, the governor threatened to veto the bill prior to passage, saying that it would force state officials to, quote, knowingly violate federal law, unquote. In June 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that federal law enforcement does have the authority to enforce federal anti-marijuana laws, even in states where the drug is legalized for medical use. The legislative vote tallies appear to show enough support to override the governor's veto, which would make Rhode Island the 11th state to sanction the use of medicinal marijuana. Less than a month out from what many expect to be a contentious convention, the struggle between leaders of the nation's largest labor group and several unions seeking changes in the way the broad movement operates is cementing around the question of how much organizing is enough. At a Washington, D.C. meeting on the week of July 1, 2005, the AFL-CIO Executive Council's 54 members voted to send the Winning for Working Families plan, crafted by AFL-CIO President John Sweeney and supporters, to the full Chicago convention at the end of July 2005. Meanwhile, the newly formed Change to Win Coalition, which recently added a sixth member to its ranks when the Carpenter Union joined, leaked a 43-page compendium of resolutions and amendments it would like to see adopted at the convention to labor writer Jonathan Tessini. The proposals include a renewed call for trade union mergers and a transfer of some powers from the AFL-CIO presidency to the affiliate unions, in addition to several resolutions addressing labor organizing efforts. Chief among those is an old demand that unions spend a certain portion of money on organizing and recruiting efforts, gain a 50% dues rebate from the umbrella organization that can be used for organizing workers within core industries represented by that union. The Sweeney Plan, originally released in April and revised on June 7, 2005, is similar in many ways to the coalition's. Both call for stronger organizing efforts and some form of consolidation. But much of Sweeney's focus is on governmental political activity, and many of the measures are voluntary. These are points of contention noted by members of the coalition. Of the two proposals, only Sweeney's is guaranteed a vote. The Change to Win coalition represents nearly 5.5 million AFL-CIO affiliated workers, more than a third of the federation's total. But only 9% of convention delegates will represent that group under AFL-CIO laws. The AFL-CIO convention begins on July 25, 2005 in Chicago. In addition to proposals to guide labor strategy, the presidency of the federation is at stake. Sweeney is widely considered the favorite in that race. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Two major decisions handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court on June 27th have serious implications for the future of freedom of information online. At stake in the case known as Brand X versus FCC was the future of open access to the broadband internet, and specifically whether cable companies have to open their networks to competing internet service providers. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled they do not. Jeff Chester is executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, one of the petitioners in the Brand X case. He says the court just extended the cable industry's monopoly power over television content distribution to the online world.
These big companies will use their last mile control to, in essence, flood the online medium and target users with all manner of commercial content, particularly from advertisers.
Without competition at the access level for broadband service, the majority of Americans will now be restricted to just two options, the cable company or dominant phone company, most likely a baby Bell. Chester says the FCC's already moved to give phone companies the same access exclusivity that cable systems have, and Congress is too far deep into the pockets of both industries to take up the issue. And although local governments have the final say on a cable system's operations via the franchise agreement process, he doesn't think that can be used to mandate open access.
The Supreme Court decision makes it even murkier whether cities, when they negotiate cable franchises, have any say whatsoever in how cable broadband serves their communities.
But the future of broadband access doesn't have to be so bleak. Chester says it's time for some serious grassroots organization to document the fallout from Brand X and begin lobbying now for regulatory changes to restore competition between internet service providers on both cable and telephone networks.
I think there has to be a kind of short and medium-term, digital guerrilla war against the cable and telephone companies. Show there is discrimination. Develop new coalitions, because there's plenty of even big companies fearful of what this means for them once the cable and telephone industry can prefer, for example, their content over others. So we're in for a multi-year campaign to try to reverse this decision.
The Supreme Court also ruled on whether developers of file-sharing software are ultimately responsible for the actions of their users. The central issue in the case of MGM versus Grokster involves the sharing of copyrighted content. The court decided that peer-to-peer program developers should be held liable for illicit content sharing, but only if it can be proven that they actively induce such behavior. Matthew Netto, general counsel for Streamcast Networks, one of two peer-to-peer companies targeted by the movie and music industries, says this ruling will chill innovation among those who seek to improve content management and distribution systems.
The guy in the garage, the gal in the executive suite, had better be very sophisticated about what they think, let alone what they communicate with each other, let alone what they communicate with their potential customers, because their every thought and their every action will now be subject to discovery in expensive litigation. It seems to me that this will be a full lawyer employment outcome. When there's this great a degree of uncertainty, lawyers are going to get pulled into every aspect of innovation and business.
Mike Godwin, legal director of the digital rights advocacy group Public Knowledge, is worried that phone and cable companies might use the ruling to preemptively filter content and thereby restrict what users can find online.
Well, the content companies come after me and say, you're providing broadband, you know that some high percentage of the people who are using your broadband services are downloading copyrighted works. There's some discussion in the majority opinion about what can be inferred from the lack of imposing filters for copyrighted works. I think that the broadband companies also feel that they may be in the crosshairs here.
However, Public Knowledge President Gigi San put a positive spin on the decision, noting that it did not outlaw file-sharing technology outright. The court also upheld a longstanding precedent that just because a technology can be used to duplicate copyrighted work should not restrict its use.
And in fact, the court reaffirmed that peer-to-peer as a technology can be used for substantial monetization uses.
It's also important to note this decision only clears the way for a lawsuit against peer-to-peer companies. And those involved in this particular litigation are confident that they can prove their innocence against charges that they actively promote copyright infringement.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stupinchik. We now feature a Truth Track, an audio documentary which hopes to rock hard as it seeks to inform, educate, and inspire. This week's Truth Track is entitled The Ironies of Kello versus New London, Connecticut. On June 23, 2005, the United States Supreme Court ruled in a key property rights case that, to quote the New York Times, fostering economic development is an appropriate use of the government's power of eminent domain. Eminent domain, in the past, referred to the justifying of seizure of private lands for public projects, like streets or roads. But now, in the wake of this ruling, it appears that corporations can also seize lands for purported corporate reigns. Or, as Moshe Adler wrote on the website counterpunch.org, quote, "The Supreme Court has now ruled that local governments may seize people's homes and businesses against their will and transfer them to private corporations if the stated purpose for the seizure is economic growth. In 1998, in order to get Pfizer to come to New London, Connecticut, the town agreed to empty the neighborhood of Fort Trumbull of its poor and middle-income residents because the corporation coveted its location on the seashore. What the court has ruled is that creating jobs and extending the tax base qualify as public use, and therefore the taking of the homes for the benefit of Pfizer are permitted by the Constitution." Unquote. This is a case which immediately elicited huge howls of outrage, and deservedly so. But it is a case also fraught with irony. We'll discuss three ironies in particular. Irony number one. The vote for this case came down to a 5-4 vote. But the irony is that the knuckle-draggers that one would think would approve this boneheaded decision actually wound up voting against it. That's right, the most conservative, and by conservative I mean right-wing fruitcake, justices on the court, Antonin "Do You Sodomize Your Wife" Scalia, Clarence "Plenty of Sexual Harassment" Thomas, and William "No Blacks Will Vote in 1964 Arizona on My Watch" Rehnquist. Those three justices all voted in dissent against corporate property rights. David Souter, considered a steadfast liberal on the court, voted with the majority. Irony number two. It has to do with the history of New London, Connecticut itself. The town wasn't always known by the name New London. It was named Pequot for the Pequot Nation which resided there until incoming population efforts came by and, well, let's let Ward Churchill tell the story in an alternative radio recording from 1998.
Pequot was one of the smaller groups in the area. Was kind of resistant to the idea that that reservation that had been created for the Plymouth colonists ought to be expanded to leisure of the colonists right on into Pequot territory. Now you had larger groups, Wampanoags and such, in the area, but Plymouth decides to make an example of the Pequots. In 1637, they do this by marching an expedition around the Pequot combatant village to attack the non-combatant village in the rear, at a place called Mystic in Connecticut now. They totally surrounded it in the dead of night, and then they torched the place, and when people came running out of the flames trying to escape, they had themselves a contest to see who could cut the most pieces, mostly with broadswords and axes. A few were shot. But basically, they hacked 800 people to death, those who were not driven back into flames to burn to death. And the accounts, in Jubilation, written by Cotton Mather, depicts these guys dancing in the midst of the flames, waving body parts over their head in an act of Christian, I forget what he said after that. So thoroughly eradicated were the Pequots thought to be by the forefathers for whom we're supposed to give thanksgiving, these homicidal maniacs that went out and utterly exterminated the people who saved them from starvation within 17 years of the event. So thoroughly eradicated were the Pequots thought to have been that the very word was officially by law abolished. You could draw a fine for saying the word Pequot. The town of Pequot became New London. The river Pequot became the Thames, names that still pertain in the maps of Connecticut.
It's an irony that the land which everyone fears could be stolen for corporate interests was itself stolen from its original inhabitants. And irony number three, courtesy of our friends at the website lyingmediabastards.com, a genius prank of the day. A clever libertarian named Logan Darrow Clements has filed plans with the city of Weare, New Hampshire, to build a hotel on the site of House Supreme Court Justice David Souter. The proposed development, called the Lost Liberty Hotel, will feature the Just Desserts Cafe and include a museum open to the public featuring a permanent exhibit on the loss of freedom in America. Instead of a Gideon's Bible, each guest will receive a free copy of Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged. Clements indicated that the hotel must be built on this particular piece of land because it is a unique site, being the home of someone largely responsible for destroying property rights for Americans. Clements said, "This is not a prank. The town of Weare has five people on the board of selectmen. If three of them vote to use the power of eminent domain to take this land from Mr. Souter, we can begin our hotel development. Isn't it ironic? Don't you think? This concludes our Truth Track. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.